Hey y'all, Irfan Elijah here. I'm excited to bring you this conversation with Blake J. Harris. But first, a quick fact. Did you know in the early 90s in the US, 1 in 3 homes had a Nintendo Entertainment Console in it? 1 in 3 homes. Nintendo had a virtual stranglehold on the video game market. But Sega, a newcomer to the game, was determined to dethrone Nintendo as the king of the console with their own new console, the Sega Genesis. Blake is going to help us unravel the details of this incredible story. Let's get into it. I'm thrilled to be joined by Blake J. Harris. Blake, do I need to use the J?
I'm really surprised that the J made it this far. My childhood friend reminded me that back in Hebrew school in fifth grade, I included the J to try to throw off a teacher and claim that I was a different Blake Harris than they were looking for. And here it is, 20 years later.
I just thought you were a huge fan of Michael J. Fox.
No, but I think there's a special exclusive club of us J initial people. Thomas J. Kalinske being included as well.
Oh, his middle initial is J? I didn't know that.
That's why we were, have such a great connection.
Wow.
But I think it sounds good, and it does sound a little pretentious. So I guess
only enough to make you seem cool.
But Michael J. Fox really did bring it a long way. He was the one that took it past the pretentiousness to that sort of like, it's kind of fun to be a little pretentious.
And now it's fun. Yeah, it's fun loving for sure. I should probably mention also, you're the author of a book called Console Wars, Sega, Nintendo, and the Battle That Defined a Generation. Appropriately titled, it's about the uprising of Nintendo, the uprising of Sega, and how they duked it out to sell more consoles than one another. I had no idea that this was such a prolific battle. It's funny because I grew up in Redmond, Washington. Right? Nintendo was right up the road. For anyone that grew up with Nintendo, Sega, you remember begging your parents for one of these consoles, or maybe several of these consoles. And I had no idea that Nintendo was such a prolific player and that Sega was kind of new to the market. I had no idea where Sega came from. All of a sudden, had the Genesis out, and I was like, oh, this exists now.
I think that a lot of us kids, I'm 31 now, so you know this really did define my childhood, and I think define those of us who grew up in the 80s and 90s. And I think a lot of us knew that Nintendo was sort of the dominant player or the Coke to Sega's Pepsi. But I don't think we knew how dominant they really were. I mean, they had over 95% of the video game market, and it had gotten to the point where, you know, Nintendo wasn't just a video game company. They were the video game company, and they were becoming, for video games, what Jacuzzi is for hot tubs. You know, they were becoming synonymous, and they actually took out ads to try to protect their trademark to say Nintendo is not synonymous with video games. You can't just use our name like that. It was really interesting to go back and see how dominant they were, and I'm particularly interested. You know, you grew up in Redmond. That's Nintendo's backyard. Were you even allowed to buy Sega systems?
Well, admittedly, I was never really a Sega person. I played Sega Genesis, but once you kind of had one of the consoles, once you got your parents to buy you one of them, we weren't in a position where I had both. There's just, my mom wasn't going to buy me both the Genesis and, you know, a Nintendo. It was like, you choose which one you want, and that's the one you're going to stick with. So I always grew up Nintendo, and I had friends that had Genesis, and I remember playing Sonic the Hedgehog here and there and some of the other like cool Nintendo or Sega games, but I never really fell in love with it. And I didn't realize that at one point they actually sold more than Nintendo did. And I think probably one of the things that surprised me the most was how intentional and how architected that market dominance was for Nintendo. Like, I just kind of always assumed, because it was always just present, that they were just the only console and that's why they were popular. But that whole dominance was like a strategy they had.
I mean, in hindsight, Nintendo became successful because they resurrected the video game industry in the 80s. And in hindsight, it's easy to think, oh, why would, you know, video games have ever gone away? Why would they need to be resurrected? They're a foregone conclusion as an entertainment medium. But they're not really. You know, the personal computer revolution was going on around that time. And, and there is a world where PCs just took off in the 80s and people played computer games, and that became the mainstream way to play games, and the video game industry just went away. So credit to Nintendo for bringing it back. And it's also credit to Sega for, as you're saying, going into the office every day, being the punchline and actually pushing through, because it's also not a foregone conclusion that there would have been multiple players in this market. And Nintendo's strategy really was, as you were describing, intentionally monopolistic, which I know sounds a little ominous, but there was a a philosophy behind what they were doing that ultimately they thought was benefiting the consumers. Similar to Apple in a way.
It is very similar to Apple in a way, yeah.
That was actually a really big turning point for me because Nintendo, in addition to the business strategies, is a notoriously tight-lipped company. It was definitely a tougher nut for me to crack to get access to speak with those people and to find out what was really going on. And so probably for the first year of my three-year research and writing process, I was hearing mostly from Sega people. And they positioned this as a David and Goliath story, which it is. And in the story, Sega was the good guy, Nintendo was the bad guy. And it's easy to fall into that narrative with Nintendo going through antitrust allegations and them sort of lacking bedside manner in certain situations. But a big turning point for me was sort of seeing Nintendo through the prism of Apple and just the philosophy behind a closed architecture system and the importance of control and how that word control definitely does have a connotation that is generally negative. But as consumers, you know, I expect a certain experience when I buy an Apple product, and it has always delivered. And same thing with Nintendo. And, right. And you can't say the same thing about Sega or Sony or Microsoft. Android. Yes.
Well, let me back up for a moment because I want to ask you, before we get into more chat about Nintendo, about Sega, how did you even get into writing this book? Because I was reading, this is your first book. You'd never written anything before. Yep. You were actually a day trader or like a commodities trader?
Yeah, I was a commodities trader.
And how do you go from that, which I'm sure you were getting paid well to do that kind of work, how did you make that transition?
Well, it was definitely, I had always wanted to be a writer, at least since I started reading books for fun when I was 18. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of one of those situations that I felt like I got my break. And that it was felt like an overnight success with Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg and Scott Rudin being involved in the feature film version of this,
which we'll talk about,
but you know, like most overnight successes, it was really a 10-year process to get right to where I wanted to go. Uh-huh. And so I graduated college in 2005. I had been writing screenplays, producing very small movies, nothing particularly successful, but I always loved writing. And how I got into this story was kind of what you were describing earlier about how, you know, once you had a system, you kind of didn't get another system, and you were either a Nintendo person or a Sega person. And I was a Nintendo person, like most people mm-hmm. in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, one in three homes in America in 1990 had a Nintendo Entertainment System, which is ridiculous, just how popular it was. And I wanted a Super Nintendo because the Nintendo was the best thing that we had going on in our house. It was the only thing that kept my brother and I as friends during our childhood years. And I distinctly remember being in the living room and us sort of, me and my brother, my younger brother, presenting our case on why we deserved and needed.
I did that same thing. I had to beg. And, you know, parents, especially at that time, they don't understand what the difference is between this console and the new console. It's like, you have a console. What do you need another one for? And I had to beg, and you had to make a case. Like, this is why I need the new one.
Yeah. I felt like I, you know, it was almost like a childhood version of a PowerPoint presentation where we're like, and so we made our case to our parents on why we needed a Super Nintendo. And my dad said, kind of as you were alluding to, he was like, what? Super Nintendo? And he said, no, we're not going to buy you a Super Nintendo because then Nintendo would just come with a Super Duper Nintendo and a Super Super Duper Nintendo.
He was right.
And he was right, certainly, although maybe he was not giving enough credit to the technological innovations between each one. But what he was really responding to was what a lot of parents felt at that time, that the Super Nintendo was not backwardly compatible. And they didn't like this notion that they had spent $1,000 or hundreds of dollars on these games and the system, and now it was all going to become obsolete. And, you know, looking back, Nintendo could have added backward compatibility for – it would have cost about an extra $75 to the consumer. So at the end of the day, it was a business decision that caused them not to do that and ultimately changed my childhood because for some reason Sega was a loophole to my parents' anti-additional console policy. And so we ended up with the Sega Genesis. And – then 3 years ago or 4 years ago now, almost, my brother got me a Sega Genesis for my birthday. Uh-huh. It was the first time I had played it since, you know, we were kids, so 20 years or so. And I picked it up, and that little moon-shaped controller in my hands was really nice and comfortable, and it brought back a lot of good memories, nostalgia, and, you know, a lot of my memories that you'll hear. I always say we because it's me and my brother, and that uh-huh. was the one thing that we had in common. I was an older brother, and I was a jerk, but when we played video games, I was friendly. And after the nostalgia, it brought up all these questions like we were talking about earlier of like, where did Sega come from? How successful was Nintendo? Yeah. All these things that I was kind of conscious of as a kid. But at the end of the day, you know, Nintendo and Sega were all just in this group of video games to me, and I never thought about the business side of it or that there was this architectural plan behind what these companies were doing. I just thought, like, a game came out, they put it in the stores, next game came out, put it in the stores, and the best games, and that was it.
Me too, yeah.
And so my favorite books are the nonfiction business stories, whether it's biographies like the Walter Isaacson Steve Jobs book or whether it's Smartest Guys in the Room or Disney War. So I went to this big Barnes & Noble on 82nd Street in Manhattan, and I was looking for the video game history section, and I was looking in the film history section, music history. I couldn't find video game history, and I went up to the information desk, and I asked the woman where it was, and she actually snickered and was like, no, we don't have that. And I thought, all right, well, can I just get one of the books on Sega or Nintendo? There was nothing. What about just something about video games, business of video games? There was nothing. And you know, they always try to order it for you, which is always funny to me because it's like, yes, I can use Amazon myself or iTunes. But she didn't even offer to order anything because there was such a limited amount of video game history books out there. The only thing that they had in the entire two-story store was walkthrough guides. So that was sort of where the idea of writing a book began to germinate, to the extent that for an industry that's so big that is bigger than film and music, I was shocked that there wasn't like the video game book, or that there wasn't several video game books that an average person, whether you're a huge gamer or not a gamer at all, could come across to find out about this really fascinating industry. And then, you know, I found some out of print books. I found some online articles, and I sort of started to get into this world. And the only thing that I thought would prevent there being a great book to write here or a great story to tell would be if the people themselves were kind of boring. Mm-hmm. And once I started speaking with them, I found that was absolutely not the case, that these people looked back on this era as one of the greatest of their lives. So there was this passion and energy there, and they loved what they did. They were very much larger than life personalities with strange quirks and just they're great storytellers. And I ended up spending 3 years researching and then writing this book really just for the last year. And it ended up being this 500-plus page behemoth about this epic story between Sega and Nintendo. And I was talking to, in addition to the feature film, which we'll talk about later, and maybe the documentary as well, I was talking to the editor the other day, and we were saying, I was asking him what he was surprised about once he came on the project. And he was saying the story was so much bigger than he ever could have imagined. And I was kind of making the comparison to like, yeah, you know, when you hear Sega and Nintendo, you imagine that it's this big Super Bowl of gladiators, this big game between Sega and Nintendo. But what the book really is not the Super Bowl. It's 5 years in this professional sport. It's five seasons. So, you know, this battle really went back and forth, and in the end created the infrastructure for the modern video game industry.
Yeah, and a lot of the strategies that kind of seem to be developed during those years, you still see today. I mean, and they seem to be playing out with Xbox versus PlayStation. It's really interesting to see some of the parallels there.
And in the end, you know, one thing that you always ask yourself as an author and as a reader when you're looking at something from 20 years ago is, why does this matter to today? In addition to those parallels, just culturally, whatever you would say about Nintendo's success, which they were absolutely successful. Video games in 1990 or so, it was kind of like the boy equivalent of a girl's tea party. Like, I remember my parents thought like it was really cute that I was playing, and it was nice, and maybe they would play with me, but it was kind of like the way that a parent would play at a tea party, like, oh yeah, let's give some to Mr. Bear. Like, they looked down upon it, and I don't think it was disparaging, but it was just a kid thing. And Sega's influence, say what you will about it, and just the way that they pushed Nintendo, it did become this more mainstream activity, and the age skewed upward. And some of that was because we were growing up during that time and we're older now. But a lot of it, too, was just the way that perception of video games, and very much to Sega's credit, you know, in a nutshell, most of their success could be due to the marketing, and marketing is all about the perception. And what they did was they changed the perception of what video games were. They were cool. They were fun. They were like movies. And that, more than any other strategy, is, I think, the big lasting influence of that battle.
Nintendo, it seemed like they were marketing their stuff to kids. I mean, to people who were probably our age at the time.
Yeah.
And then as you said, they had like 90+% of the market share. If you played a console, you played Nintendo. Super Mario Brothers is what you played. And then Sega comes along. And maybe you could talk a little bit to what their strategy was and how they kind of got their foot in the door and started to really move a lot of consoles, because a lot of those strategies are still used today.
You know, the way that I wanted this story to be relatable to gamers and non-gamers alike was to really focus on the characters, and particularly the book focuses on Tom Kalinske,
right,
who before he even gets to Sega, I realized that this guy more than any other was responsible for my childhood, aside from my parents.
Is that because he played with Barbies?
Yes. Whether it was being the one boy who played with Barbies or Matchbox cars or Flintstones chewable vitamins, you know, this guy basically throughout the late 60s, 70s, and 80s was just had a hand in so many of these hits, these iconic toys from our childhood.
So we should probably say, like, this guy helped develop and make popular Barbie. He helped create Flintstones chewable vitamins, right?
Yeah, He-Man, Popples, which was always a favorite toy of mine.
You know, the thing that just absolutely blows my mind, and this relates to the strategy from these video game companies as well, is how architected these things were. Like, you just kind of think they happened organically. Like, oh, like some woman created Barbie, and then maybe she sold it at a local fair, and then it got popular. It's like, no. They developed the toy, and they would develop narratives just so kids would like them and that you would get your parents to buy them for you. It blows my mind how much psychology was built into these toys. Even back then, they were not trying to sell toys. They were trying to make money, and toys was the medium that they used. It kind of made it, I don't want to say it cheapened it for me, but it kind of robbed a small part of my childhood. I'll be honest. It's like, wait a second. You guys were just trying to make money off me?
No. I mean, I think that's a fair way to feel. I mean, well, you feel that way, so it's fair regardless. But, you know, some readers have responded by almost being disappointed that these men and women behind the scenes, they weren't just like hardcore gamers who happened to also be making money, that there was a deliberate business sense to this. And maybe at first for me learning that, it was like a little bit disappointing, but then you think back and how would it be any other way? Would it really just be these guys who loved games creating these global companies and putting them out? I mean, I think it had to be a balance between, loving the games and appreciating what they were and also having the business sense to figure out how to monetize it. I mean, any business that is their goal, these were both publicly traded companies in Japan. So, I guess it's interesting that there weren't, you know, I think unlike the previous generation, I think Atari was a little different. Atari was sort of these programmers and these underdogs who were making games and having parties and doing drugs, but also making money. But that didn't really work out in the end. and so Sega, you know, it's sort of the way that it became, you know, when I began to see what this book would be and what it could be was with Tom Kalinske. So this guy who had such a big part, such a big hand in our childhoods. And he sort of, in 1990, down on his luck a bit, between jobs, on a beach in Hawaii, trying to figure out his next career move. So he's on this family vacation, and while he's lounging on the beach, Hayao Nakayama, the dictatorial CEO of Sega Enterprises in Japan, finds him and says, "Tom, I've been looking for you." And Tom's sort of like, "What are you doing here? Why are you looking for me?" And he says, "I want you to run Sega and take on Nintendo." And Tom responded something like, "Can you get out of the way? You're blocking the sun," something sarcastic. And sort of they go on to talk, and Tom's like flattered by this opportunity. But he doesn't really know the first thing about video games and doesn't know why he would be the guy to take on Nintendo. And as you alluded to earlier, it was sort of like a fool's errand to try to take on Nintendo. You know, the best case scenario was, you know, Steve Race, one of the characters in the book, in the documentary, he describes it as Sega was number two, but they were really like 16th. Like nobody was even close to Nintendo. And so Tom, you know, from what little he knew about video games was that Sega had no chance. But in the middle of his family vacation, he left and went to Japan to check out the technology, the 16-bit technology, which was the Genesis, the handheld, which was the Game Gear, some CD stuff they had in development, and he was really just blown away. At the end of the day, it would be the games that sell, but they definitely had better technology than what Nintendo was offering. And so he decided to take on this job of bringing down Nintendo. And some of the first things he did was sort of encapsulated in this famous meeting. It took place a couple months after he took over. He went to Japan, which was the parent company, and he presented a four-point plan of things that Sega of America should do if they actually wanted to compete with Nintendo. And one of it was to lower the price. Another was to bundle their upcoming game, Sonic the Hedgehog, their flagship game, with the software.
Which was like, I mean, that was a crazy idea at the time, right? I mean, to take your flagship game and give it away for free.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in other cases, if the game had come out for a year, then they included it, wouldn't it be that bad?
Uh-huh.
You know, people could respond, okay, after you've already made your money. But the way, you know, the hardware, these companies basically make no money on the hardware. It all comes from the software. It's a razors and razor blades business. So to just sort of give away your best razor blade for free seemed blasphemous to them.
Uh-huh.
He also wanted to do more American games like sports, and he wanted to go after Nintendo directly in advertising, which just wasn't done in Japan. And so he delivered this speech a couple months after taking over, and all the board of directors are sort of murmuring and talking, and they're outraged by how ridiculous this guy's ideas are. This is supposed to be the great white hope over there in America.
Uh-huh.
And so Tom's sort of getting it part translated from his right-hand man, Shinobu Toyota, who's trying to use some discretion and not tell him everything that they're saying because it's not very good.
Uh-huh.
But at the end of the day, credit to Hayao Nakayama. He's not very happy about this either, but he said, I hired you to do things your way, so do it your way. So that was sort of the beginning of Sega's assault on Nintendo. And they had about 9 months from there to kind of prepare for Nintendo's launch of the Super Nintendo. And that was sort of the big punch in the face that they knew they were going to have to take at some point. And if they could blunt that blow and still be left standing, they felt like they could compete with Nintendo and eventually take them down. And then that's exactly what they did. Sega really was an underdog company at the time, and sort of kind of in the way described in the Malcolm Gladwell book, David and Goliath, you know, they were able to take risks that the market leader would never take. And those things really worked to Sega's advantage. They were much more nimble than Nintendo. And they were only about a 50-person operation at the time. They ballooned to about 1,000 within a few years when they passed Nintendo. But it was just really fun. They were to try to capture that atmosphere as much as the facts, because that was so much of what was the corporate identity and why they were able to compete with Nintendo.
I mean, you talk about Sega being in second place, but that, as you said, that second place was so far down because Nintendo was the king. I mean, everybody loved Nintendo. And what I didn't realize was Sega couldn't even get their stuff in stores because people didn't want to make Nintendo mad, because Nintendo was basically printing money. I mean, and they were intentionally not even supplying as many consoles and games as these, I guess, I mean, what would you call the place that sold video games at those times? Electronics stores? Is that who was primarily moving this stuff?
Yeah, well, I mean, mostly it was toy stores. Like, I was looking at some stats the other day, and in 1989, of the top 30 toys sold in the entire year, 25 of them were Nintendo products or games or, you know, related paraphernalia. And Nintendo, for most toy stores, accounted for about 20 to 25% of their profits.
Wow.
So this is like, you know, they would have that beautiful World of Nintendo display in these stores, mm-hmm. but it was a small part of the stores. It wasn't 25% of the stores, uh-huh. and they were accounting for so much of these companies' businesses. And where it really started to hit home for me was hearing about the situation with Walmart, where Tom Clancy went down to Walmart, showed them the Sega Genesis, said this is a superior system, here's why the games look better. And the buyer there, who's also sort of a dispassionate person, but in the business of making money, was sort of like, yeah, that's great. I'm sure it might be better than Nintendo. I don't care, but we're not going to piss off Nintendo.
Right.
And so even if Sega at the time had Sonic the Hedgehog or the greatest game ever, they couldn't get into the stores because these retailers were making money. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Why ruffle Nintendo's feathers? And Nintendo had a reputation for if retailers did things that they didn't like, if they even lowered the suggested retail price by a penny, then maybe mysteriously the next shipment wouldn't have everything they wanted in it. And in Nintendo's defense, they would say that they were doing this to ensure quality control and that the video game industry had imploded 7 years earlier because there was a lack of quality control. So they mm-hmm. thought they were doing God's work by doing some of these, you know, things that they were later charged with. But Sega couldn't even get into the stores. And so one of the things that they did in the case of Walmart was when they felt like they really did have a superior product, not just with the hardware, but Sonic the Hedgehog and other games, they went down to Bentonville, Arkansas, which is where the company headquarters are, and there's a flagship Walmart store there, and they didn't sell Sega products, of course, and so across the street, they set up a Genesis store, which invited people to come in and play the Genesis for free around the clock, and it was just supposed to basically get people in this town to fall in love with Genesis. They bought every billboard in the city. They put seat cushions at the football games. And eventually Bentonville, Arkansas, the home of Walmart, was so overrun with people wanting to buy Genesis and being unable to do so that they threw their hands in the air and said, all right, fine, we'll start carrying the Genesis. And that was sort of indicative of Sega strategies and their sort of grassroots campaigning during the time.
To be that persistent is kind of incredible, because they were going up against such huge odds and they were being so creative in their marketing strategies. It would have been so easy just to be like, yeah, this is just not going to work, and quit, especially because, you know, Tom Kalinske is working for Sega of America, and Sega of Japan, even they doubt that what he's doing is smart. I mean,
yeah.
he kind of, like, even his own company is telling him that he needs to not do business in the way that he's doing it, and to keep his head on straight and pursue all those ideas that he had and then have it succeed must just be incredible.
Absolutely. I mean, I can't stress enough that this really was a team effort. I talk about Tom a lot in the book and in this interview, and he deserves all the credit in the world, but it was a team effort. And, you know, he wasn't always the one who had the idea. He wasn't always the one that executed the idea, but he was the one who, as you're describing, was at the head of the ship and sort of kept that optimistic spirit. When you're doing something unorthodox and you're trying to change the pace, it's hard to keep feeling confident in what you're doing when you're not getting the feedback right away. I mean, if you're trying, a press defense in basketball, which is sort of the underdog defense, and you start getting steals, at least you can say, all right, this is exhausting and it's a little bit aggressive, but it's working. But when it's not working, it's hard to keep saying, let's keep trying. We got to stick to the strategy. But that's what Sega did. And then about a year after Tom took over and a few months after Sonic the Hedgehog came out, they really started to see those results. And it was an enormous accomplishment. It was probably a big reason why these people all look back and remember it fondly as one of the greatest times of their lives. And it was very deserved. You know, it was really hard what they were doing, and not even with things that I didn't think would be difficult or where I didn't suspect conflict, I found that there was such a complex and rich history to it. Like Sonic the Hedgehog being another example. Sonic was a very successful game. Most people liked it. Some people thought it was too fast, but regardless, it was very successful. And, you know, as a consumer, as a kid at the time, I just thought, like, these games were made, they came out, and that at least the game part of it was not related to marketing or not related to the business side. But I learned that was completely inaccurate, because Sega of Japan, who created most of the games, especially when Tom first took over, had come up with this game, Sonic the Hedgehog, and it was a really fast game. It was unlike anything on Nintendo. But the character of Sonic himself, the initial incarnation of him, he had fangs, he had a collar, he was, you know, very aggressive, spiky looking. He had a busty girlfriend named Madonna. He was in a rock band. And so all these elements, which ended up not being part of the final game, it was sort of this conflict between Sega of America, who are marketing gurus, and Sega of Japan. It was focused on just the game itself. And they went back and forth arguing about what Sonic could be and what he represented. And that, you know, is really the first sign of this foreshadowing battle between Sega of America and Sega of Japan. And also, once again, in that situation, Hayao Nakayama said, you know, this is why we hired Tom. We want America to be successful with this product. The American market is bigger than the Japanese market. So even though Sega of Japan had created the game, they gave Sega of America discretion to sort of create the character in their image, and it was enormously successful. But interestingly enough, you know, if you look at Sonic now, he looks much more like the original Sonic, which I noticed in that game, Sonic Generations, or a couple years later. They had the original Sonic, who is this, like, cute and adorable, but also very edgy little guy with attitude. And then there was the really tall and lanky, punkish-looking Sonic of today, or at least a few years ago.
They need to bring back his girlfriend, Madonna. That's going to increase sales. Wasn't his name something really weird, too? What was his original name? It wasn't Sonic the Hedgehog.
Right. The original drawing and name was Mr. Needle Mouse.
Mr. Needle Mouse and Madonna take on Ring World.
Yeah.
I made up that last part. But yeah. That's so funny. Yeah.
I don't know. It makes you think, like, you know, I never gave as much thought to, like, you know, how much the titles and the branding and all this went into what was be successful. Cause you know, the underlying property is the game, and it wouldn't have changed that much, but the way that we perceive it through all these things really does make a difference. And Sega, you see that, you know, I think that I don't know that that Sonic the Hedgehog was any more groundbreaking of a game for Sega than Crash Bandicoot later was for Sony. Mm-hmm. But there's a reason that Sonic is still around 20 years later and it's still as beloved as ever, whereas Crash and other popular games aren't. They just don't have the legs. They don't have the backstory. They don't have that cultural impact that Sega was able to capture with Sonic.
Do you still play Sonic games?
I mean, I have, because it's business market research. Okay. It's a write-off to my
business. I mean, I was never really a huge Sonic guy. I was never really into him. And I don't really know anyone that likes Sonic the Hedgehog games. So I thought maybe you could shed some light. Like, what's so appealing about those games? Because I just have to admit, I don't get it.
Well, I don't say I wouldn't. I feel like I get it why he was popular, but I too was like you. I was not a huge Sonic lover. Mm-hmm. I did have a Sega Genesis, and I had wanted a Super Nintendo. But I would have said back then, and probably even now, I'm more of a Mario guy than a Sonic guy. The other great thing about Sonic was that he really personified Sega's identity. They were loud, in your face, really edgy, and really fast. Mm-hmm. And that's not really me. I'm much more slow, plodding along like Mario. I like exploring things. I like, you know, slowly creeping up. I like checking, is that pipe? Could I go down it? No? Okay, let me try the next one. Uh-huh. I'm not in a hurry. But I guess that people really like graphic sophistication, and Sonic really exemplified that. It was unlike what Mario could do. He was really fast, and the skill in that game was less about exploring and finding things, but about doing things very quickly and getting to the end as fast as possible. And, not just – I'm thinking of the Green Hill Zone in Sonic, the first one, but also in the second game, there was that casino level, which I felt like just totally epitomized what Sonic was. It was just like he was almost like a pinball in a game or in this casino slot machine. It was like bouncing all around. That's what Sonic is. And I think that actually – for me, it takes a little bit of getting used to. So I probably wasn't as much into Sonic as other people were during that time. But once I got to the point where it wasn't just like I felt like I was pushing a button and then going, and then I'd reach the end of the level by bouncing and bouncing and bouncing, and I actually felt like I had some control over the nuance, that was when I began to appreciate Sonic. It was, how can you still control things while moving very fast and very, very quickly?
Let me ask you this. So eventually, Sega succeeds, and they get up to, what, 55% of the market share? I mean, they actually are selling more consoles than Nintendo is.
Yep.
What happened? I mean, Sega is gone. You don't see them anywhere anymore. They sell video games still, and every time you go to an arcade, you still see them in there. But what happened that made it obsolete?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the sad thing about doing this book all along is that as much as it was a David and Goliath story, it was really a rise and fall story. And I knew that, you know, the last 25% of the book was going to be how this company pulled off this impossible dream. And then it all fell apart. Mm-hmm. I mean, Sega is still around nowadays as a software company, mm-hmm. like Activision or Electronic Arts. But they're not where they should have been and could have been, and where they wanted to be back in that time period. And so what happened was in 1993, they finally surpassed Nintendo. Probably the big turning point was the Mortal Kombat game, which came out on the Genesis with the blood code and was gory and graphic. And the Nintendo version had green blood and was watered down. And the Sega version outsold them like 5-1. And so there was a few things that happened. The one that really, you know, jumps out and was probably a big part of it was that, as much as I thought this book about the battle between Sega and Nintendo would be about the battle between Sega and Nintendo, you know, the second half and sort of the underlying battle throughout this friction is because there's friction between Sega of America and Sega of Japan, the subsidiary and the parent company. For as successful as Sega was during the early 90s, and as much as we kids remember the schoolyard battle, like, you know, fighting to our death for either Sega or Nintendo, that wasn't happening in Japan. In Japan, Nintendo, Super Nintendo, or the Super Famicom, it was called over there, was selling about 3 to 5 million units every year. Mm-hmm. And the Mega Drive, what Genesis was called over there, never even sold over a million units. So you have this situation where the parent company that is responsible for the hardware, and at least is responsible for most of the software or a good amount of it, and basically has the same products as what they have in America, is so extraordinarily less successful. And I think that emotionally there's jealousy and they want to, you know, they're not as interested in helping America. Mm-hmm. But from a business standpoint too, you know, even if you were to take that emotional component out or, you know, try to understand why they were doing what they were doing. They were not successful with the Mega Drive, so they wanted to go on to the next system. They wanted to go on to the next generation and be the first to plant their flag in 32 bits, the same way that they had been with the 16 bits. And Sega of America didn't really want to do that because they were just hitting their stride. And then even when they sort of relented because they had no choice, and Sega moved on to the next generation, Sega of Japan did things that really hurt America's chances of succeeding. The most direct being, there's some stories in the book about how Sega could have had a partnership with Sony and basically launched the PlayStation together with Sony. And they also had the opportunity to develop a system with Silicon Graphics, which provided the main chipset for the Nintendo 64. So Sega had the opportunity to partner jointly with the two systems that defeated it in the end.
Well, hold on, I don't want to let you gloss over that, because I thought this was really hilarious. So the PlayStation was originally supposed to be a disc-based attachment for a Sega system, right?
Well, it was actually first supposed to be for this for Nintendo.
Oh, it was supposed to be for Nintendo.
The sort of like the B storyline throughout the entire book is just like this story of Sony, who is like treated like the bastard child throughout this whole story, and in the end, beat Sega and Nintendo. And so, as early as 1991 at the Consumer Electronics Show, Nintendo is supposed to announce this partnership with Sony to create a CD attachment for the Super Nintendo. And then at the last minute, they sort of stab Sony in the back, or at least they announce a partnership with someone that's not Sony, and they don't really go about it the best way in dealing with Sony. And that gets Sony angry. And sort of one of Tom's big strategies was to form alliances with those who didn't like Nintendo, whether it was retailers who were unhappy that Nintendo had been so controlling, or whether it was third-party licensees that had been dealing with Nintendo's strict guidelines, or whether it was just consumers who wanted freedom instead of, you know, wanted that choice instead of Nintendo's control. People like Galoob, who made the Game Genie. Nintendo sued Galoob for making this Game Genie. Sega said, come on down, let's be friends. Same thing with Blockbuster and the home rental companies. Nintendo sued Blockbuster and mom and pop video stores for renting out video games. Sega said, that's a great idea. You know, we think, but why don't you try it before you buy it? And so Sony was a natural ally. And, you know, the first step in that relationship was to make games for the Sega CD. You know, the interesting thing about Sony and Microsoft nowadays being the leaders of the console business is that neither of their pedigrees come from the arcade video game world. They both, Sony made their money in consumer electronics, and Microsoft obviously made it in the computer world. And so Sony didn't really know how to make video games. I mean, to oversimplify it, they didn't have that background, whereas Sega had been an arcade company since the 60s, and Nintendo had been an arcade company since the 70s. And so Sega, in effect, taught them how to make video games, or they had this sort of informal relationship where we teach you how to make video games, and you exclusively make games for us. And that happened with the Sega CD, and then they were trying to take that relationship one step further and jointly release the what would have been the Sega PlayStation or some variation of that. And they spent 6 months working together, trying to come together and on a mutual architecture. And at the end, Sega of Japan was unable to agree with Sony. And, you know, that put Tom in this position where he's not a tech guy. So it's sort of like when you go to the auto shop and the guy says, oh, you need a new Johnson rod, $5,000. And you're sort of like, all right, that, yeah. Like, yeah, I guess. I mean, everything he was being told was that what Sega of Japan was developing, which became the Saturn, was not very good. And not even just for the technical specs, but just it was really hard to develop for. And that ended up being a problem in the end. And so Sega potential relationship with Sony fell apart. And a similar thing happened with Silicon Graphics, which ended up working with Nintendo to make the Nintendo 64. And so there's some poetic justice to the fact that Sega had the opportunity to get their hands on these two systems that ended up defeating them in the end. And then also even just smaller things, like when the system was launched, you know, I think that one of the lessons that you see throughout this book, not just in this generation, but in the others discussed, is that, you know, the name of the game is the game. You need to have the software, and that it's important to have a strong library when you're trying to sell a system. And Sega of Japan upped the launch of the Sega Saturn, and it was supposed to come out in September, which would have given Sega at least enough time to implement their marketing plan for it. But then they were told at the last minute to launch it in May at the first E3, the first video game trade show. So, you know, they lost 4 months there. And, you know, that incident alone sort of like was so representative of undoing everything Sega had done. You know, if you look back at the beginning of the story where Sega is trying to, you know, Nintendo has such bad relationships with retailers and Sega tries to use that to their advantage. And when they launched this hardware, not only did they not have the software to support it, but they didn't even have the hardware. They only had 400,000 units that would be ready by May. So everybody who loved Sega by then wanted to sell the system, and they had to shortchange just about everyone and decide, you know, whether they wanted to give everyone 1/10 of their initial order or whether they just wanted to pick 3 retailers and give them their full order and upset everyone else. And they ended up choosing that one, and they upset so many of the retailers. So they ended up almost back where they started at the beginning of the story. It's kind of sad.
You know, it's funny too. You talk about how Sega was going after more adults, and they were edgy and kind of cool, and Nintendo has always been associated with kids and kids games. I feel like that's still Nintendo's biggest problem. And that's still how people think about them. You have Sony out there making games for mature gamers. Xbox does the same, or at least they support games for mature gamers. And then you have consoles like the Wii and the Wii U, which are they're a little esoteric. Not everyone understands how you're even supposed to, like, you know, interface with these systems. And a lot of the games seem kind of juvenile, and Nintendo still doesn't have a lot of third-party support. Their popular games are still the ones that they make. Those are still the ones that everyone likes. Where do you see Nintendo at today? Because they're obviously not as popular as they once were. And quite honestly, I'm a little worried about them. You know? Like, I kind of wonder if they'll be here in 5 years.
Well, I'm a little worried about them too. And I think the fact that you're worried about them speaks to the idea that we all sort of have this special love for Nintendo. There's this place in our heart where we remember growing up with Nintendo. And I think that that's what they need to exploit more of. Mm-hmm. You know, we're now in our 30s, or at least, I don't know how old you are, but it's been a couple decades.
19, yeah.
and so, you know, Nintendo really was and still is like the Disney of video games. You know, they still have that scrubbed and clean identity. They still have that, you know, lovable, optimistic Mushroom Kingdom world that they've offered to us. And there is certainly a market for that. You know, the Wii U hasn't done as well as they wanted. The Wii did very well. But, you know, there are people who like that. But then there's those of us who have grown up. And I feel like they need to find a way to reach this audience as well as the young kids of today. You know, I think one way for them to do that would be to do more with their IPs. That, you know, the one thing that Disney has that Nintendo also has is these incredible IPs like Mario, Zelda, or Link from Zelda, Kirby, Donkey Kong. And you see, you know, Marvel in a similar situation where they've taken their great IPs and created this Marvel universe and have movies and obviously the comics, but action figures and everything. And Nintendo, because they have such a commitment to control, and because they're so resistant to let other people, you know, distribute their products and do things with their IPs, has been pretty reticent about going forward with that. I'm sure some of it can be attributed to the awful Mario movie from 1993.
We're still recovering from that. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think that there's a way. And I think that Disney at times has been able to achieve it, where, you know, we all know Mickey Mouse is the smiling guy for kids, but they also have movies that do skew older. They don't have to be like dark horror movies. But whether it's Toy Story 3, which is for kids, but it's definitely also for adults, or whether it's just, you know, one of their sub brands that's a little bit skewed up.
Star Wars now.
Yeah.
I mean, talking about skewing older. Yeah,
absolutely. I would love to see Nintendo get more into targeting a specifically 30 and 40 year old audience, whether it's a Netflix streaming show that's more of an experiment for them, or whether it's a new movie, or whether it's just a graphic novel that shows you the seedier side of the underbelly of the Mushroom Kingdom, of something that I just feel like that wouldn't betray their very special and magical brand, but also makes them seem conscious of the fact that that we've grown up, and that there's players out there who stay away from the Wii and the Wii U, not even because they wouldn't like it, but just because it seems complicated or just doesn't seem like for them.
For me, the Wii U, I love the Wii U. I think it's a great product, but there's not enough games to warrant me owning the system. I sold my Wii a while ago because the only game I liked was Nintendo Sports. And that game was awesome, but all the other games that were released, third-party games, just weren't really all that fun to me. And it's the same with the Wii U. It's like they got to bring in some more mature games, like you said, to kind of like retain, you know, like us older audience. Like, I don't really want to play kids' games. I don't want to play Wario Land. I played that one, and it was a little bit too hectic and manic for me. What about iOS, Android? Nintendo has often been criticized for not bringing in any of their IP to those platforms, and we've talked about this on our show before. I think it's such a good opportunity for them, right? Because it's so accessible to kids everywhere. Take some of your older games, like, I don't know, Super Mario Brothers 1, put it on iOS, and make a whole new generation of people, of kids, fall in love with your products again. Because once us older guys die off, who's going to be buying Nintendo stuff?
I don't know, man. That's like, that one I don't understand at all. I feel like I had said in an interview a few months ago, and some people criticized me for it. I said that they should release Super Mario Brothers 1 for iOS and give it away for free, even just to increase the install base of the Wii U. If you get 10 million people downloading that, and just even saying, oh yeah, I remember how great Nintendo was.
Yeah.
Some person is going to buy the Wii U.
Totally.
And I don't think that they need it, you know, they don't need it monetized anymore from Mario 1. And I was actually wondering, you would know this better than I, how is it that, you know, on the iPhone, you know, Google Chrome is available, Google Maps is available, and vice versa with the Android and some Apple products. Why does Apple open their system up to that?
I think that Apple kind of welcomes anyone into their ecosystem. I don't think that they're trying to control the kind of experiences you get there. I think that it benefits them, and that's probably why they allow Google Maps and all these other kind of competing applications in, because like, you may be using Chrome, but you're using it on iOS, right? And Apple's bottom line is always sell hardware. They're a hardware company, and they're very clear about that. So if they can provide you an excellent experience in the store with, you know, a plethora of apps to choose from, then even though they may have a competing product, it's still better for them because you're still playing in their world, and that's where they want you.
And that's what I was thinking of with Nintendo, because their response to our argument would be, you know, if you really wanted to play Mario 1, buy a DS and play. You know, it's available for you to download in the Nintendo Virtual Store, which is our version of the iTunes Store.
I think that's such a bad argument.
But it should also be available in Google Play and also in an iTunes Store. What do you have to lose? You know, why not be available on a competing platform, and hopefully it'll bring people to your world? And what I just don't see what they have to lose.
I mean, it's like when people bought iPods and they loved them so much they ended up buying other Apple products. Right. It's the exact same thing. I mean, wherever you can get people to have your experience, I think is a good thing. Because if they're not buying your Wii, if they're not buying your Wii U, if they're not buying your Nintendo DS, well, making the argument, well, if you want to play if you really wanted to play Mario, you should come to our platform. That's not the way it works, I don't think. I mean, you have to go to where the people are, and then enchant them in that place. And then if they like what they're experiencing, they'll come and buy other products from you, like the Wii U. Because I mean, if you played a really fun game on iOS and you really loved it, you might think, hey, the Wii U actually might have some games I might be interested in. What better way to sell your console than to get it into people's hands on the devices they already use?
Exactly. And there's the direct translation of, all right, if you liked Mario 1 for free or for 99 cents or for $5 even, or whatever they're doing on the iOS, we're selling a $50 version of the new Mario for the Wii U. So why don't you try that? And that'll bring people to your ecosystem. So I don't know why Nintendo was so resistant to that idea. And that seems like a good starting place for them. But I guess the other thing is that you know, they've been very disciplined over the years, in a way that Sega and nobody else really has financially. And so, you know, there's rumors that they would be okay even at these losses, for sustaining these losses for the next 30 plus years. So, I don't know if Nintendo's going to change their way, because they do have the war chest to back up their stubbornness.
I mean, I can't imagine where they're going to go from Wii U. What's the next console? You know, what else? Where else? They've already done Motion. And Motion, yeah, I feel like, has kind of fizzled. It's burned itself out. It was really fun on the Wii. But serious gamers don't want to do motion controls. They want to have controllers. And if they're releasing new consoles that are just marginally more powerful than the one before it, like the Wii U is, it's kind of a marginal increase in quality from the Wii. You got HD video games, which is right. Cool. I don't really know where they're going to go from here. It doesn't really seem like they could sell another console, because the Wii U isn't even selling very well. So, I mean, what can they do next? I have no idea. I think iOS is their next best bet. Release some games on iOS, get people hooked again, and then get people interested in your IP. Because, I mean, it is all about the game, right? Ultimately, that's all people care about. You have to have really good games in order for them to buy your consoles. And you have to have a big enough library to support buying a whole new console. Like, you can't just release two great Mario Brothers games and expect that to sell, you know, a trillion Wii U's. Because I would love to have a Wii U, but I just can't justify a reason to buy one. It's like, what am I going to play, Mario Kart? That actually is actually quite tempting, honestly.
Yeah. I should just say, the only console I own now is a Wii U, or the only next-gen console I own.
Oh, really? So I was going to ask you that. So you don't own a PlayStation 4, no Xbox One?
I have a PS3, and what I've mostly been playing is the Wii U. And I think that even in since the book came out, in May, so it's been 3 or 4 months since then, Nintendo has started to turn a corner a little bit. They're definitely not where they want to be with the Wii U, but releasing Mario Kart 8, I think, was a really good step. You know, some people are on the fence now whether they should buy it. And at E3, I would say of all the three big console companies, Nintendo was the winner. They had the best games. That, you know, I feel like they're starting to creep forward and sort of, you know, maybe they aren't doing what the IP is what I would like to see as a movie and TV lover, to see stuff, you know, stuff in that realm. But they are introducing an open world Zelda game, so that sort of, you know, moves more towards a Grand Theft Auto type
that
feel.
That could be very cool.
They have the new Smash Brothers game coming out. They have a bunch of cool. There was a new an adventure game with Toad, so that felt to me even just like good. Like, all right, he's a pretty good, cute little IP. Let's do more with him. So I think that they're moving in the right direction software wise. I mean, all the games are great. So that, you know, you always get from Nintendo good games, but not the kinds of good games they're making, I think, are growing up a little bit. And I'm happy with the direction that they're going in that. I'm very curious, though, what they would do with a new console going forward. But I will say, you know, they surprised people with the Wii. They had just come off the GameCube. People were having these same conversations about, is Nintendo done, or, you know, what would they even do next with the console? And they introduced, or they at least introduced in a popular way, the motion gaming. And then I was surprised that they went away from that with the Wii U and sort of went to a tablet-centric gaming experience, which I don't think has been super successful for them in that regard. So basically what I'm saying is, I don't know what they're working on next, but I think that their next console isn't just going to be better graphics. It's going to be some other gameplay innovation.
You're probably right. There's going to be some kind of hook to it that's not just, hey, better graphics, faster frame rates, right? That's not really been their thing. The other thing they need to do is really embrace online gameplay, because they have been so slow to do that. And Xbox, Microsoft was really smart, realizing that's where we were all headed. And now Xbox One, you got a little bit of Xbox Live, 360, of course, it proliferated, and now it's just ubiquitous. Everyone knows. If you have a console, you have to be able to play with your friends online in these games. Imagine if you could play Mario Brothers 1, Mario Brothers 3, even that simple old school game, but you could play it online with your friends where you're both
playing. Or Mario Party, even.
Or Mario Party, or Luigi's Haunted Mansion, which is on Wii U, which is such a fun game. If you could play that online, it's kind of like a cultural difference, right? Because I think probably like in Japan, maybe a lot of people play in the same space, like physically in the same space. And here, I don't ever see my friends at my house to play video games. In fact, I want them to stay at their own house so I can use my full screen, right? I don't want to share a screen with someone anymore. I'm not 12.
No, you're totally right. You know, that does speak to some of the other differences between Nintendo and Microsoft. And I mean, Sony is a Japanese company as well, but I feel like they've really embraced a Western side to their game making. Mm-hmm. Nintendo, you know, throughout the course of my book, was very much Japanese controlled, and didn't give as much autonomy to America as Sega had given to Sega of America. And so, you know, Nintendo has been much more of a classic traditional Japanese company, and maybe that's partly why they've been slower to embrace innovation and changes to the company's DNA. But they're the Hiroshi Yamauchi, who was responsible for sort of getting them into the video game world, passed away last year. And I do think that even in the year since he's passed away, Nintendo's been a little quicker in evolving, and maybe, you know, there's more acceptance on their part to get into things that we felt like they should have been doing years ago.
Let me ask you, let me go back to the book for a moment. We've been talking about all these great stories, and one of the things I kept thinking as I was going through all these stories, one after the other, is how many people did you talk to? How did you get all these stories, all these inside stories? How did the research process work for you?
So it started with, I was able to speak with Tom Kalinske. Mm-hmm. You know, I kind of felt like I wanted to see if there was an interesting story here, and if anyone could tell me, it would be him. And two, if he was not interested in being helpful and speaking with me, you know, it'd be really hard to tell the story. And
Tom Kalinske's he was a CEO of Sega of America, right?
Yeah, from 1990 to 1996. Mm-hmm. And then I won't spoil the ending, but he goes on to do a bunch of other things. And currently, he's involved with Blackboard. He's heavily involved with Cabrium Learning, and also he's on the board of Leapfrog. He's still heavily involved in the toy industry. And so, you know, I spoke with him for a couple hours, and I felt like, all right, there is a story here that I want to tell. And my best resource was one that I had made so much fun of over the years, which is LinkedIn. I thought it was, you know, Facebook for work. But I typed in Sega, or I typed in Nintendo, and, you know, hundreds of people would come up, and it would say what years they were there. Uh-huh. And, you know, having never written a book before, I can understand why people didn't really want to give me the time of day. So it was just like a numbers game. All right, you know, 20% of people would respond to me and speak with me. And at first, you know, it was just a matter, I would speak with anybody, whether it was a janitor who worked at Nintendo for a day or whether it was a game designer at Sega for 5 years. I just wanted to hear the story from as many different angles as possible. And then as I started to grow that network, you know, it really helped. After about 6 months, I got to the point where I could probably get in touch with just about anyone because somebody knew somebody. And so that really put me in a good position. I ended up conducting about 300 interviews, but let's just say 250 very specific to Sega and Nintendo. You know, I'm a big sports fan, so I talked to a lot of people from Electronic Arts that were involved with EA Sports, which was kind of related. But there's just so much fun information to uncover. And so after about 6 months working on this, I was able to speak with most of the people that I wanted to. And then at the same time, I put together a treatment of the story that was sort of like an early book proposal, about 25 page overview of the story that was even more so for my benefit than anybody else's, just to make sure that, you know, this was coming together and that there was an interesting story here. And that, you know, I sent it to some of the interview subjects. And that really, I think that really enabled them to open up even more. They saw that the story was, and they all saw that I was, or at least transparent in the sense of what I was trying to do. You know, I felt like as much as I wanted to capture the facts and figures, I did want to capture the spirit and the atmosphere, which I think was really conducive to what they were doing. And so, you know, getting compliments from them or getting suggestions from them was more helpful for me than it was even for them. But around that time, I also asked my manager to send the treatment to Seth Rogen, because I knew he was a big video game fan, and I thought that in terms of helping to popularize the story for a mainstream audience and for a nerd audience like myself, Seth was the perfect guy. And I thought, you know, it was a million to one chance Seth would actually look at it and care about it.
Seth Rogen, for those people that don't know, actor, writer, producer.
You know, he did Freaks and Geeks.
Pineapple Express.
He was just in Neighbors with Zac Efron. He has a new movie coming out, The Interview with James Franco, where they're starting a that's kind of starting a third world war between us and North Korea. Right.
So you decided you're going to send your treatment to him just on a whim. Just fingers crossed, let's give it a shot. And what happened next?
So what happened next was I was shocked to find out that he wanted to meet. And I was so excited by this.
I can only imagine.
It's like, actually. So we were meeting on January 6th of 2012. And so it was like December of the, you know, a month before. And I was at a holiday party with my family members, mm-hmm. like, all my cousins, my grandma, all my closest family members. And I clinked my glass together. I hadn't told them this yet. And I put my arm around my girlfriend of 5 years then, and I said I had big news, big announcement to make, and everyone thought I was going to announce my engagement. And,
oh, you jerk! You did. Oh,
yeah, it was kind of foolishly thought out on my part, but I said after 5 years of dating Katie, this wonderful girl who you all love, I'm so pleased to announce that on January 6th, I'm meeting with Seth Rogen. Katie didn't like that at first, but she eventually found it very funny. And sort of as a nice ending to the story, a year later, I did propose to her.
Oh, good, good.
After selling the book. But it was kind of a jerk move on my part. But it also speaks to how excited I was. And listen, getting engaged and being with Katie is the best thing that ever happened to me. But it's, you know, meeting with Seth Rogen and getting him on board was a close second. Yeah. So I met with Seth Rogen and his business writing directing partner, Evan Goldberg, and also their producer, James Weaver. And so we met in Los Angeles. We met for a few hours. You know, I was surprised not only that he wanted to meet with me, but that they gave me 2 hours, that it was a dialogue. It wasn't just me talking about why I thought this was cool.
Yeah.
You know, Seth and Evan are not just business collaborators and creative collaborators, but they're childhood friends, and their friendship, you know, was very much like ours, mm-hmm. childhood friendships based on video games. So mm-hmm. that was sort of the common currency, and they thought there was just a great opportunity here to tell a video game story. And the fact that this one was so fascinating and had so many twists and turns and sort of, you know, could be likened to The Social Network, but with video game, made it, you know, get us all very excited. So after that, we decided that we were going to do a documentary that I was going to direct with my business partner, Jonah Tulis, mm-hmm. as well as a feature film that at the time they were going to be involved with the produce, and then later decided they also wanted to write and direct. And then the other big break kind of came about 9 months after that, when they met with Scott Rudin, who is the producer on so many of the best movies of the past 20, 30 years, mm-hmm. including The Social Network, which was based on Ben Mezrich's book, Moneyball, and so many other books that were my inspiration for writing this. And he came on board to produce the potential movie, and we sold it to Sony Pictures. And so we sort of had this dream team in place.
Wow.
And, you know, not only am I trying to name drop and get my name associated with Seth, Evan, and Scott, but in terms of your original question of my interview process and how I was able to get people to speak with me and share these stories, you know,
that one opens thing some I learned, doors for you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one thing I learned from Sega success is, you know, I consider myself an underdog, and definitely back then, having never sold anything and done anything, you know, you use what advantages you have and you just focus on those things. And, you know, once I had, you know, those relationships in place, for all the people who had stubbed me for the past couple of years, now was the time to go back and say, here's all these things that are going on. You know, specifically some of the subjects that were a bigger part of the story that hadn't spoke with me. I said, you know, there's a movie, there's a documentary, there's a book. These things are all happening now. And you are a big part of the story. And up to this point, I've only heard about you secondhand. And it's a lot of times from your competitors. So if you're okay with that, I'm okay with that. But maybe you don't want to be okay with that. And so, you know, I ended up in speaking with every single person on my list that I wanted to speak with, except for Minoru Arakawa, who was the president of Nintendo of America during this time. I never imagined that I would be able to speak with him. His father-in-law was Mr. Yamauchi, who passed away last year. Mm-hmm. And at the time, he was still running Nintendo. And, he, you know, there's a interesting family dynamic there. So I never thought that that would really happen. But getting to speak with Howard Lincoln, who became the chairman of Nintendo of America, and Peter Main and Gail Tilden and Tony Harmon, all these people, you know, it was really helpful to, you know, the time period, the fact that that I had 3 years to work on this was a really big part of why I was able to get the access I was. Because, you know, even when you first speak with someone, they're not going to tell you, you know,
the good stuff.
The good stuff. And you also, and, you know, as a writer, like, you, even when you get the story, the anecdote written down, you don't have such a good sense of who they are, why they did what they did, how they feel. So that, you know, you're not even able to harness it as much as you are later able to do so after knowing them for a couple of years. And so in that regard too, doing the documentary was very helpful in writing the book, because we were filming that simultaneously. So if I'm writing a chapter about Peter Main, who was the EVP at Nintendo for sales and marketing, you know, I'd spoken to him several times on the phone and, met him once before, but spending a whole day with him or a couple of days with him and interviewing him, walking around his house, having lunch with him, that really helped tell you more about who these people are and helps you write them.
Yeah. And as you said, you're trying to capture the spirit of this battle and the characters. I'm sure that just helped immensely. I mean, you get to know the guy, you kind of know how the way he talks, like the way he thinks, you know, like, and you can add that, and you can definitely tell that when you're reading the book. Like, you don't just get the dry information, like the spirit of that time, the spirit of the battle between Nintendo and Sega, and the spirit of those systems. I mean, that is something that you walk away with after you read the book. Like, especially if you live through it, it takes you right back there. And especially for me, because, like, you were during part of the book talking about the mall tour that Sega was doing, and you're talking about Alderwood Mall. I used to go to Alderwood Mall all the time. I mean, I had no idea this. All these great stories were happening all around me. I mean, all these places that you spoke about were the places that I grew up. And so for me especially, it had a special place in my heart. Yeah. Let me ask you, the movie, the documentary, when can people expect to see these things? When are they going to be finished? When are they going to be out?
So at the time when I was writing the book and we were filming the documentary, I was not very happy to be doing both at the same time, because it kept having to switch gears mentally. But now I'm glad that both are done and they were beneficial to one another. And so we've already shot all of our interviews, or at least all of our principal interviews for the documentary. We're in post-production now, towards middle or the end of the edit. So hopefully by the end of the year, we'll have the documentary done. And, I'd love for it to be in theaters next year. Early next year, it should be ready. And then the feature film, Seth and Evan are planning to start writing the script in the fall, so pretty shortly. And the fact that we've been collaborating with them for 2 years on this documentary, and they've seen the book, develop, I think it's a little bit different than other adaptations where, it's almost like a studio picks up a property. Here, you guys read the book, write the movie. It's been very collaborative. So sort of every step forward with the book, and particularly with the documentary, has been a step forward for the feature film as well. And so there's a lot more, many more question marks when it comes to movies being made and when they're released and everything. But I would hope that, that the documentary would come out next year and that the feature film would come out the year after that.
Exciting time to be you.
Yeah.
I can only imagine. That's just incredible to go from where you were to where you are now. It must feel kind of like a dream. I mean, it is.
It really does.
A dream come true, huh?
It is totally a dream come true. And it was nice even just finishing the book. I was happy to be done, but sad not to be writing about that world anymore, because as much as this was, something I was being paid to do, it was a labor of love. And that's why I worked on it without being paid for so long, because I loved it. And so it's nice for me not to have to leave that world and to still continue to be making the documentary, searching for archival headlines, which I was doing earlier today. And I just love it all. And the fact that we get to be involved with the feature film as well. Yes, it's really fun to be me. And the best part about it all, or one of the parts that still makes me so happy, is the fact, it's a true story. It's nonfiction. It's about these people who, I think that when you walk into a Barnes & Noble, there should be a book about them that really changed the video game industry and made the video game industry. And so for me to be able to shine a spotlight on these people, like, we had a panel at Comic-Con with Tom Kalinske, Alan Nilsson, Bill White from Nintendo and then at Sega, and Perrin Kaplan, who was the corporate communications woman at Nintendo. These people, they weren't getting these opportunities previously. And it's been an honor for me to be able to share their story with others. And, I look to be able to continue to do that. It's been so fun. And the best compliments I've gotten from the book have been from those who lived through the story and the story's about, saying, you nailed it. This is exactly what the feeling was like. This is what it was like to be there. And, you would know better than most that you know, with Apple, for example, you know, I don't think it's just the products they make or their financial numbers that tell the story of Apple, particularly with Steve Jobs. You know, I don't think that what made him such a great and unique leader was, you know, just an idea on a page. It was his personality and that force of the personality.
Yeah, his very being. Yeah.
Yeah. And so being able to capture that part of the story as opposed to just here's what happened means a lot to me and makes me feel like, you know, this book will have a long life and be helpful to people, you know, in any kind of business and be appealing to gamers and non-gamers alike.
What's next after the movie? More books? More movies? What's going to happen for you?
You tell me. I'm trying to figure that out now.
I'm thinking Console Wars 2, the battle between PlayStation and Xbox.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I in the meantime, I'm going to be writing some articles for IGN and some other places.
Oh, nice. That's great.
Other video games. Yeah, because there's, you know, as hard as it might be to believe, even though the book is 500 plus pages, I really did try to keep it very specific to this narrative. Mm-hmm. And so in the case of EA Sports or hundreds of other great characters and great stories, I didn't put in the book, even though they were fascinating and had, you know, interesting, never before told things, but they didn't drive the story forward. So I'm going to try to find an outlet to tell some of those stories and also look for a topic for next book.
Well, the book's called Console Wars, Sega, Nintendo, and the Battle That Defined a Generation. It's available everywhere. I'll put a plug in for the audiobook version, which is the one I consumed. It was great. The guy who read it, I don't know what his name was. I wish I did. But
his name's Fred Berman.
Fred Berman did a great job. Give Fred a pat on the back for me. I really liked his...
He
does different voices and stuff to like narrate the book.
Yeah.
And it really brought a lot of life to the story. Hey Blake, it's been great talking with you. If people wanted to find you on the internet, like, and reach out to you, how would they best do that?
Twitter is the best way. My name there is Blake J. Harris, NYC, and I love getting the word out about the story. So if you have any questions, whether you've read the book or not, please feel free to contact me at Blake J. Harris, NYC, and I'd love to tell you more.
I'm looking for you right now. There we go. You just got a new follower. Well, thanks again, Blake, for coming on. It has been fun. I want to thank everyone for sticking around for a second hour all the way to the end. You made it. Good for you guys. My name is Eric Fun Elijah, and I'll see you guys next time.